Audio Smut is like having sex in a boxing ring.
Rough and ready.
We're going to talk with sex workers. We're going to talk with queer folks. We're going to talk with trans folks. We're going to talk with people who make comics, people who write books, people who need to talk about sex and can't.
Audio Smut is creative sexuality, weird sexuality.
What turns you on? Education, politics, culture. We've got it all.
That was amazing.
When I have sex, I think about radio. When I have radio, I think about sex.
Audio Smut has already interviewed Annie Sprinkle, Tom Waugh, Suicide Girls, your best friend, your neighbor.
Audio Smut airs on CKUT 90.3 the first Wednesday of every month from 6 to 7 p.m. Tune in and get off.
Yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Minui. You're listening to Audio Smut at CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 6 o'clock, and today I am inviting you to a very special show. It is a show about grief and intimacy. And this show is something that I've been thinking about for a few months now because, yep, this year has been a very tragically special year for me because I did lost my father in a sudden accident. And there is a lot of questions that arises when you deal with grief for the first time, and probably for every grief that are coming your way the rest of your life. And I've been doing my own researches through art, literature, nonfiction, healers, mediums, whatever. And one of the things that has been really hard for me to uncover or to think about or to read about is the relationship to intimacy in all its ways. It is something that is said that grief will change your address book, that grief is a physiological phenomenon that will affect every area of your life, that grief will just transform your life if you let yourself be transformed by it. But today, because I was living with these questions, I extended my questions to a few friends of mine in order to create a space where we can think and talk about together about the relationship to grief, to our body, our pleasures, a relationship to ourselves and to others. I've also asked people to send me text, people who couldn't be there, so throughout the hour, I will also be reading through some anonymous texts that I've received. And the first text that I want to read before we go into the conversation with the three amazing persons that are around the table with me today that I will introduce to you in a few minutes is a text that one of my dear friends sent to me in the first weeks of me mourning my father. And it's a text by Judith Butler in her book Precarious Life, Powers of Violence and Mourning. So I will read it to you now. Despite our differences in location and history, my guess is that it's possible to appeal to a we, for all of us have some notion of what it is to have lost somebody. Loss has made a tenuous we of us all. And if we have lost, then it follows that we have had, that we have desired and loved, that we have struggled to find the conditions for our desire. Perhaps mourning has to do with agreeing to undergo a transformation. Perhaps one should say submitting to a transformation. The full result one cannot know in advance. There is losing, as we know, but there is also the transformative effect of loss, and this latter cannot be charted or planned. When we lose someone, we do not always know what it is in that person that has been lost. So when one loses, one is also faced with something enigmatic. Something is hiding in the loss. Something is lost within the recesses of loss. If mourning involves knowing what one has lost, then mourning would be maintained by its enigmatic dimension, by the experience of not knowing, incited by losing what we cannot fully fathom. Something about who we are is revealed, something that delineates the ties we have to others. that shows us that these ties constitute what we are, ties and bonds that compose us. It is not as if I exists independently over here and then simply loses a you over there, especially if the attachment to you composes who I am. If I lose you under these conditions, then I don't only mourn the loss, but I become inscrutable to myself. Who am I without you? When we lose some of these ties by which we are constituted, we do not know who we are or what to do. On one level, I think I have lost you, only to discover that I have gone missing as well.
Ready?
Yeah.
The wind has turned to fish poles, the cities are seas, the cars are drowning underneath your feet. The children are swimming from the top of the trees, crowds of umbrellas are standing misbelief. Mary kept sewing, holding on to a TV, even if the water is rising past her knees. Here comes the river, coming on strong, but you can't keep it. Shoulders, you're gonna stand through it all.
So this was the beautiful song Here Comes the River by Patrick Watson. He wrote this song, I believe, when his father died. You're listening to Audio Smut, and this is the Grief and Intimacy Show. And to talk about this topic, I will now let my guests introduce themselves to talk a bit about who they are and why they accepted my invitation to come on this very special edition.
Okay, so I'll start. My name is Mathilde, and I'm an artist under the name La Mathilde. I use my video, my sound, and everything to work on the mourning of the loss I had in my life. And I accepted to come because we had a talk last week together, and we were talking about traumas and the effect on our bodies. And I think it's important to have those talk now, because we were all into a moment of COVID and all that, and we have a lot of impact on our mind and bodies, and sometimes we don't think it's about mourning, and we have to have that talk. Mm-hmm. That's why I said, I'm coming.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I lost a friend a few years ago to end-stage bowel disease, and my friend B had been writing about being critically and chronically ill queer for a long time as a doctoral student. And after she died, I kept rereading her master's thesis, and we started to have a kind of asynchronous conversation together about her ideas that started to become a book that I'm writing about living with her death.
Thank you, Sarah.
Hi, I go by Ness. I am queer, and I make a living using language. I am a linguist, and I'm very fond of words, and I live for these kinds of conversations, quality conversations, around topics that impact the deepest core of our being. And the person that I lost, whose loss completely transformed my life, is my mother, my birth mother, which happened 4 years ago, and it was a very complex grief due to the nature of her ability and of our relationship, which I'll expand on later.
Thank you so much, you three, for coming to talk about this topic that is indeed really intimate, vulnerable, and taboo. And to open the floor of this conversation, I was wondering if you could talk to us a bit more about how did those losses or this grief change your relationship to yourself or to your body, to your senses or your pleasure?
Who starts?
Well, I want to say that I was not prepared for that loss. It was the first time I was losing someone who was close to me, someone I loved. I was in my early 30s. I was also recently, quote-unquote, divorced, living on my own for the first time in my life. And the year prior to my mother's passing, I had been in a very, very expansive area of my life, just freshly, again, quote-unquote, divorced, fully exploring the aspects of myself that I had always been there, that I had started exploring, but only kind of in fractions. And so, like, truly diving into my queerness, diving into non-monogamy, diving into what it means to put community at the center of your life, instead of putting the family of origin at the center of your life, or putting the one, like the capital T, capital O, the one, your romantic partner at the center of your life. And so I was very empowered. I was also very fragilized when that came. It was very sudden. I was basically told she had 2 to 3 months left to live, and that it was an avoidable cancer. It could have been treated. She could have had, like, many years more ahead of her. that could have been negotiated through medical interventions. And she passed exactly 2 months after. And I can definitely start by saying, like, if I had to sum up everything I could share today, is the word obliterated. Like, this absolutely obliterated my life. I have childhood friends later on who, with whom I was able to talk about losing one's mother, one's birth mother. Especially, well, I was in foster care, and so this was my birth mother. And so, like, I remember talking with one of my other foster care friends, another girl who was in foster care in the same foster family at the same time that I was. She had a very different experience. When she lost her mother, she, by that time, she had a partner. She had 3 kids and a house, and she had a very, very steep, like, community of faith practice. And so she was able to, like, cry for 3 days, and then the love of Jesus come into her heart, and then she just kept going with her life, you know, as it was before, which is what she told me. And I can tell you, I had the absolutely opposite experience. I was in a very exploratory phase of my life. I remember I was in a triad at the time, the first time in my life. I had already, like, a solid 10 years of non-monogamy under my belt, but it had always been, like, hierarchical, polymono, mostly, like, heterosexual relationships. And now I was this very queer dynamic. I had, like, a queer platonic partner, like, on the side from the triad. I also had, like, a platonic, strictly kinky partner on the side, dating people of all genders at the same time, going to play parties abundantly, just dating a lot, having a lot of fun, you know, meeting a lot of people, and spending a lot of time within the larger polyamorous community in Montreal. So, like, I had good support, but it was within this void of not having, of grief having been evacuated and whitewashed, right, by capitalism, by colonial culture. I'm a settler. I'm a multi-generation settler. And so when I grew up in some kind of mild Catholicism that I left pretty early. And so there were no rituals around grief. Like, and do not tell me that, like, eating the little sandwiches at the funeral home, do not tell me that that counts, you know, as a ritual. Like, I'm sorry. Like, one of my great aunties that I had never seen before, who showed up to the funeral, she was like, oh, stop crying. Think about happy things. You know, that is not a ritual. Like, it is not going to help me. It's not going to help me process this. It's not going to help me dive into, like, the absolute true horror of, like, having the ground opening from under your feet. Like, none of these is going to help, especially since my mother had not made these arrangements. And so I had to kind of, It was absolutely awful. I had to negotiate while she was in palliative care. My uncle took me to the funeral home, and my uncle was a contractor. And so the funeral home, the son of the funeral home owner, was a client of my uncle's. So we weren't able to negotiate a deal. It was just awful, awful, awful. Like, just like, and just thinking about, like, Jesus flipping tables in the temple. Like, it's just like the original table flipping. It, you know, it was done by Jesus in the first century, you know. Consumerism. And so just, I did not know that the death doula was a thing. Like, there were nobody knew, I mean, what to do. My partners and their parents, they gave me a lot of presents, and they did show up, even though they were recent partners. But nobody they also didn't know. Like, we were all disenfranchised in this. Like, nobody had this kind of death-informed, grief-informed, trauma-informed, ritual-informed in this way. And so there was a massive deterioration of my intimate life, of my emotional life, of my relationships, of my social life that happened not only the weeks, but the months. And I want to say, like, a solid year and a half. It's just me living by myself, like literally, almost quite literally kicking my partners out the door, you know, and like half of them were like, Vanessa, I can't do this. You're not emotionally available. And the other half, I was like, I can't handle your bullshit, you know? So like, it was a nice half-half split, but it was just me being like, I hate everybody. I can't deal with anybody's like imperfections or slight, you know? I'm just thinking of some kind of anime or cartoon character who like magical powers, who just like you kind of manifest like a huge like puff of air around you that obliterates like a huge sphere around you. It was kind of like that. I was like, I do not want, like, I want to be alone. I want nothing around me, like within a 1 kilometer radius. And I got it. Yay. I achieved that. And I coped using the means that capitalism wants to give you, you know, like watching a lot of TV, watching a lot of Netflix, drinking alone in your apartment, like in your apartment building where like you don't know your neighbors because your landlord wants, you know, to make, like he wants to profit off of you guys. So you can't, anyway, it was awful. And I'm talking about like this lack of, I'm talking about grief being evacuated from culture at our expense because we have to be like productive, like everything we do has to be profitable, not to someone else, you know. And I'm just kind of remembering a little bit of the anger I was feeling, and at the same time I was able to be alone with myself. And so not all of it was healthy, not all of it was intentional, but I developed like an intimacy with myself. Oh, I love being alone. I love curating my apartment to make it look nice. I love being in this bubble. I love being in this cocoon. And like, I don't see it as a silver lining necessarily, but I guess as like what I'm sharing, like this aspect of my grief that I'm sharing is just to show you how like I went from like 180 degrees to the lifestyle I had before of like going to parties, being very sociable, having a ton of people around me, just to being like completely alone. It was quite extreme.
I was thinking about, you know, the question and the changes to my relationship to myself and my body and my pleasure. And yeah, you know, it's interesting what Ness was saying about, you know, not having kind of these rituals in our culture to deal with grief. I was lucky because I had a really dear friend who invited me. I'm Jewish, but I hadn't been kind of practicing, but she invited me to kind of come to shul, and do the high holiday services, which specifically on Yom Kippur, they have a service that is about, you know, you stand up in shul if you've lost someone in the past year and everyone in the congregation sees you and holds you. And so I had access to some very beautiful rituals around grief. But I also tried to make some of my own rituals. And one thing that, you know, I did within the first 6 months after B died was that I decided to get my first tattoo, a memorial tattoo. And I actually got the same tattoo that she had, which was a tattoo that it was a heart with a dagger and it said, look closer on it. And it was right above the place on her arm where nurses would put the IV or the, and it was kind of a message to them because people saw her and looked at her and they saw this healthy person. And it was really challenging. And so I planned this tattoo for a few months and I had it, instead of saying, look closer, I had it say her name on it. And I gave the tattoo artist a birthday card, the last birthday card she'd ever given me with her handwritten signature. And we put that on the banner. And it was interesting. I think that the ritual is powerful because it's about doing something irreversible and permanent. And, you know, when you're freshly grieving, I mean, it's like you're just coming face to face with the permanence and the reality of death. But the moment the tattoo was over, I just felt so disappointed. I was like, oh, I don't know what I thought. I thought this was gonna give her back to me somehow, but it was just like, it was just ink, you know? But shortly, you know, like about a year and a half later, I got out of a long-term relationship and I started Tinder dating, and it was kind of this nice opportunity, like, you know, when you get naked with new people and then they're like, oh, what's this tattoo? And then I felt like I had this opportunity to talk about my friend, and you know, I kind of didn't want to have pleasure without her there. Like, I remember this one time someone just kind of put their hand on her signature and was like, what does that say? And I said her name, and it just kind of sat there in the air. And like, you know, I think they could tell that it was really heavy, and we didn't have to go into the story, but it just felt really good to have her be part of this hookup with me. And so, yeah, I'll stop there.
I will engage with the community. Actually, I lost a lot of friends and member in suicidal. And the first one was when I was 21, and he did it at a party I was making. And the second one is a friend who died by cancer. And the third is my brother who killed himself. And other people died by suicide, but les proches, comme ça, it affected my reality with my body and my friends. But the first one was all about grieving with process. We couldn't do anything because he died and his family wanted to do something without us being the community of people around. And it was important for us to do something like a ritual, and we never had the moment to do it. So, and the girlfriend I was at that time didn't want to know what was going on, didn't want to acknowledge the fact that my body and my mind were not there anymore. So it was very difficult, and as Ness, you said, I had to leave her because she was so much into the life, and I was so much into the why did it go, why it's affecting me like that, why my libido is not there anymore, and I'm not interested in being in my body anymore. I just wanted to deal with it and make art and photos and being obsessive about doing a thing, because we are in a society of production and you don't have the time to mourn, never, because people will always say, oh, c'est bon, passe à autre chose, vas-y, dépasse, t'as autre chose à penser, il faut vivre, il est mort, c'est pas important, il faut être dans la vie, on est des vivants, go and make things. So the moment you can't do anything with your body and your mind is not accepted by the society and the people you live with. And it puts you in a dans des situations où tu as des énergies complètement différentes autour de toi. Et c'est impossible de négocier, en fait, cet échange d'énergie, en fait. Donc, tu es dans un moment où tu te retrouves seul et tu as besoin d'être seul pour doing some mourning, but alone. And you can do a mourning alone, because mourning is all about connecting to other people so that you are seen, heard, and all the other deaths were kind of similar, except for my other friend who died by cancer, because we were a community over there. We made something, and we made it like living, and we had a time to grieve together and to cry, and my body didn't react at all. On the contrary, actually, I had a moment of very alive and love and wanting to share physical things with the friends. And when my brother died, it was the same moment as my first friend, that the body shut down, the mind shut down, and I had to leave my girlfriend because I couldn't react with my body, I couldn't have sex, I couldn't have love, I couldn't love anymore. I couldn't be on the same energy again. And it's all about how do you connect with other people when your mind can't find an easy place to rest, taking the time to rest. We don't have that time. And it's all about that now. How do you give back to yourself that time, which depends on everybody, time to rest the mind and the body, and accepting that, I mean, we are body and mind intertwined, and it's all so important what it does to our brain and our bodies. So giving us the time, and some people should give us the time, you know, like a society should say, well, you lost someone, I see you, and now you can have a year of mourning if you want, a year of not doing anything and not talking to people and just be in there and trying to get back your mind and your body to be one again.
Thank you, you three. Something that people listening at the radio right now can't witness is all the nodding that is happening around the table, and it resonates with what you all have been saying, that mourning needs to be witnessed and seen and live with other people, but it's also very hard sometimes to witness it or to live it with other people that I haven't been in those contexts. And it makes me think about, for me, it's been really hard to share anything about the grief I've been experiencing. And one of the experiences that's been really helpful for me was to create a club of dead parent, a club. We've met like a few times once a month with people who had written to me saying, hey, like it happened to me too. And most of these people, I didn't talk about it either. And I was like, wow, like we really need to like just sit down all together. And we ended up being a big group of people around their 30s having lost a parent, and I didn't knew that before, and it felt like when my father died I entered a new club. And I think someone said that to me the first week, like, hey, welcome to Dead Parents Club. And I thought it was interesting that this club is absolutely invisible to the unmourning eye. And before we go into the next section of this conversation, I wanted to read a text by Nick Cave. Nick Cave is a musician. Actually, a lot of people send me his album. It's by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. It's an album called Ghostine. So Nick Cave lost his teenage boy. And he has now a website in which people can write to him about grief, and he answers. And one of these answers just really touched my heart, so I wanted to share it with you all before we move on, and I'll play a little extract of Ghostine. Susie and I have learned much about the nature of grief over recent years. We have come to see that grief is not something you pass through, as there is no other side. For us, grief became a way of life, an approach to living where we learn to yield to the uncertainty of the world, whilst maintaining a sense of defiance to its indifference. We surrendered to something over which we had no control, but which we refused to take lying down. Grief became both an act of submission and of resistance, a place of acute vulnerability, where over time we developed a heightened sense of the brittleness of existence. Eventually, this awareness of life's fragility led us back to the world transformed. We discovered that grief was much more than just despair. We found grief contained many things: happiness, empathy, commonality, sorrow, fury, joy, forgiveness, combativeness, gratitude, awe, and even a certain peace. For us, grief became an attitude, a belief system, a doctrine, a conscious inhabiting of our vulnerable selves, protected and enriched by the absence of the one we loved and that we lost. In the end, grief is an entirety. It is doing the dishes, watching Netflix, reading a book, Zooming friends, sitting alone, or indeed shifting furniture around. Grief is all things reimagined through the ever-emerging wounds of the world. It revealed to us that we had no control over events, and as we confronted our powerlessness, we came to see this powerlessness as a kind of spiritual freedom. Susie's grief has become part of her chemistry. It moves through her bloodstream like a force, and though she often inhabits the liminal space at the edge of dreams, she remains strong in her powerlessness and obstinately awed by the workings of the world.
a horse is prancing in the pastures of the Lord. Oh, the train is coming, and I'm standing here to see. And it's bringing my baby right back to me. Well, there are some things it's hard to explain, but my baby's coming home now on the 5:30 train.
Join Cinema Politica for a winter screening series. Every Monday evening, 7 o'clock, in H110 at Concordia's Hall Building. Our winter 2023 program responds to the conservative rejection of society's ability to thrive, grow, and develop. Instead, we show the voices of those within social movements confronting ableism, systemic racism, heteropatriarchy, and many other intersectional struggles. We invite you to join us every Monday at 7 p.m. throughout the winter and spring at Concordia University in the Hall Building, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, room H110. More info, cinemapolitica.org. This screening series is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
Hi, everybody. So you're still listening to Audio Smut at CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 6:37, and this is the Grief and Intimacy show. So we are with three other people around the table talking about grief and intimacy. And just before we come back to the conversation, I received two texts about grief, of anonymous texts that of people wanted to talk about how grief changed their relationships. And so I'm just going to read them to you. The first one says,
J'ai perdu mon père à l'âge de 10 ans. Il était aussi mon meilleur ami. À partir de ce moment, le deuil a formé ma vie, l'a teinté de sa charge et de signification. Il a aussi influencé mes relations et mes expériences. Idéalisé et cristallisé dans le temps, mon père est devenu légende, un exemple à suivre pour le meilleur et pour le pire. J'ai archivé tout ce que j'ai pu de lui, ce qu'il restait, et les objets sont devenus extensions de sa conscience, œuvre d'art, matière à prière. Avec les années, quand des gens se sont rapprochés de moi, partenaires ou amis, j'ai fait la même chose avec eux. Le même travail d'archivage et même d'idéalisation, par peur ou par compulsion, sachant trop bien qu'on ne sait jamais quand le sol peut se dérober sous nos pieds et que la vie est fragile. Quand j'ai commencé à avoir des proches suicidaires, des sonnettes d'alarme se sont enclenchées dans ma tête. Le stress et le trauma de la perte ont pris le dessus, au point de brouiller les limites entre rêve et réalité. Un pied constamment dans l'autre monde, ce fut le début pour moi de ce qu'on appelle des psychoses affectives. Le deuil m'a donné une urgence paniquante de vivre. Pour moi, intimité rime avec intensité. C'est de pousser chaque connexion forte jusqu'au bout, par peur de manquer ma shot, par peur que la mort nous sépare avant. Alors, à l'aube des 15 ans du décès de mon père, je tente toujours de process la disparition de mon meilleur ami dans cette vie et à trouver l'équilibre dans mes relations intimes comme sexuelles. Dans les dernières années, j'ai eu la chance d'être en relation avec quelqu'un qui a aussi perdu son père prématurément. C'était précieux de pouvoir échanger à ce sujet tout en se comprenant dans une intimité guérisseuse. Maintenant, je me demande si ma tendance à l'extrême dévotion, en amour surtout, ne serait pas finalement liée directement au deuil. Je travaille là-dessus.
When my father died, it was such a shock. I lived in numbness for a few weeks. It had never happened to me before to not feel anything. It's hard to feel desire or pleasure when you feel nothing at all. And when you feel something, it's terror. My nervous system was literally on fire. Grief has this way of making you feel completely alone, like you are in a tunnel and people are speaking to you, but they are so far, even when they are close. But eventually you are human, we are animals, so you want to touch other people. I needed to touch other people so much, to be reminded of how human and how alive I was. I think I needed to co-regulate with others. But when my friends hugged me, I didn't felt anything. I was single and I couldn't let anyone near me. I just felt so raw, and it just felt so vulnerable. But I was realizing I needed skin-to-skin contact, so I started going on dates again. A few weeks after my father died, I went on a date with a girl. We made out, and it made me feel so alive. I loved it. But when we went back home and I brought her in my intimacy, I felt so sad. I realized I didn't knew her, and that didn't fill the craving of my longing to be cradled and loved. So I started crying. She understood. She hugged me and she left. To start the conversation on how grief changed relationship, Sarah, I think you brought the text. Maybe if you want to read it, and then we can go open table conversation.
Thank you. Before I get into the text, I'll say that one of the ways that I think my relationships have really changed from grief has been in the way that I experience anticipatory grief, which is, you know, mourning that takes place before a certain death or loss. And in a memoir I really loved about her friend's death, because I haven't found a lot of books that specifically focus on the loss of friends, Sarah Manguso aptly points out that the trouble with anticipatory grief is that every death is certain. If I know you, she writes, you've died in my imagination. And so as part of my grief process, I've been compulsively writing gratitude letters to people in my life. And I'm going to read part of a letter that's also an essay called A Letter in Which I Invite My Parents Into My Chosen Family. You may have some inkling that no event in my adult life has been more impactful than B's death. Not even the end of my marriage during my second round of IVF, when my deep yearning for a positive pregnancy result turned on a dime into contemplating the prospect of my first abortion. While the heavy, pressing pain in my chest, the physical sensations we call heartbreak, was indistinguishable to my unknowing body from what I bore after B died. My mind said otherwise. I thought, my marriage to Lem is over, but Lem lives. I can send him a text message and he will receive it. My final text to B, I love you, will forever go unanswered. Nothing brings back the nightmare of her death more viscerally than recalling myself glued to my phone, waiting for the ellipsis to hearken her response. And then a little bit later in the letter, my kinship with B has reframed the loss of motherhood, or perhaps more accurately, a particular motherhood, dreamed up and planned over an 8-year relationship. In Hanya Yanagihara's novel, A Little Life, the protagonist's mentor and chosen family, who had lost a child, says, I've never been one of those people, I know you aren't either, who feels that the love one has for a child is somehow a superior love, one more meaningful, more significant, and grander than any other. But it is a singular love, because it is a love whose foundation is not physical attraction, or pleasure, or intellect, but fear. You have never known fear until you have a child, and maybe that is what tricks us into thinking that it is more magnificent, because the fear itself is more magnificent. Every day, your first thought is not, I love him, but how is he? My desire to have a child has always been fueled by my curiosity about this somehow superior love. this unique and powerful parent-child bond. It was also about my positive experience being parented by you both and the great joy you seem to take in your three children. What wasn't there to want to replicate? As I have grappled with the end of my marriage and losing my unconceived child, I realized I was also grieving a deeply desired future with you both, as grandparents to my children. I couldn't conceive of our future as a family outside of that. I'm 35 years old as I write this. It's not yet too late for me to get pregnant, and even once it becomes physically impossible, it will not be too late for me to become a mother. But losing B acquainted me intimately with death, and having made this terrible acquaintance, I am forced to think also about life, my life. A life where to love means to always already be sitting and wake. As the doors to motherhood continue to close for me, it is my connection to B that allows me to accept this uncertainty. I know that even if normative, procreative family is unavailable or simply undesirable to me, the family I form will be just as strong. But claiming my dead friend as kin reveals other possibilities for my connection with you, Mom and Dad. If my friendship with B was familial, could my filial love for you become something more chosen? How can we know each other differently? What are the conversations we will regret not having? I'm not sure I agree with Yana Gihara's character that you have never known fear until you have a child. I didn't see B's death coming, but your deaths have always been my greatest fear. I'm writing this because, as the dying and the grieving well know, time is now. It's time I choose you.
Thank you. That was beautiful. Yeah, like, if any of you want to, like, think or reflect about how the grief you've been through, how did it impacted your relationship to others or to relationships in general?
You want to go? Let's see. Thank you. I think that you heard, like, the dominant color of my experience with death and grief was anger. And anger is a very, like, action-oriented emotion, an impulse. And I think me grieving my mother's death was particularly, it had to make me, like, it was meant to make me very, very angry, because she had been very neglectful. She was not able to take care for me. Society was not able to care for her and help her care for me. She was also very abusive, even until the very end. And the foster family that I ended up in, long-term, sort of like an open adoption, was also very neglectful and very abusive. And I was not aware of it still at the time my mother died. And so this massive anger, like, fast forward a few years, well, let's say 2 years at the beginning of the pandemic, it basically made me... And when Minuit said at the very beginning, like, grief will make you change your address book, I think that's a beautiful, like, very understated, euphemistic, like, metonymy for, yeah, I basically had to realize, like, these people are not supporting me, these people are supporting me. And I think it changed. The word love became, like, an action verb, not just like a thought you have for someone or a feeling. And I also think I have two different definitions of grief, and basically the grief that I felt immediately following my mother's death, now I wouldn't call it grief. Because during the pandemic, I started doing trauma-informed somatic therapy, like, very, very, and for the first time in my life, I was able to really dive into the immense complex trauma that was my life and the losses of childhood, which are not only related to death. And so, like, now I have two definitions of grief. Like, and I'm realizing this, like, live right now in this show. It's like definitely the first year and a half, 2 years, that wasn't true. It was not reparative. Like, it wasn't reparateur. Like, it was not healing grief. It was not generative. It was not transformative. It was just pain I was not able to digest day after day after day after day. Things stuck in my stomach with like stomach acid, just like churning, like eating me from the inside because I had no support to metabolize the pain. And I didn't know how to metabolize the pain, and I was not metabolizing the pain. So the pain was just perpetuating itself. And the isolation was not helping. And so when I discovered what grief actually can be, can mean, and I don't think everybody knows this. I think people can have access and awareness of this at various levels. But now grief, I welcome grief. Like the second definition of grief, that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate into words, but like when grief comes into my day, my week, any given month now, I'm actually so happy. Like I don't aspire to have a life made only of joy. Like I love my anger. It makes me protect myself because now I know how to use it, you know, and now I know how to metabolize. I go through like cycles, you know, like the emotion appears, I learn something about myself, I sit with the pain, and then it makes me, and once I'm giving the time, as Metzil said, like giving myself the time, and being having surrounded myself with new people who celebrate for me to have the time and for me to give myself that time, then I am prompted to act in ways that will give me what I lost or what I thought I had or what I was expected to get. And so I just love grief because it undoes part of my trauma and it makes me more able to self-regulate my emotions and to be more present into my own life. And now I don't think we can have a life without grief, and I don't think we should. I think a life without grief, like the joy you're having is not a real joy if you're completely frozen, if you're numb. And I know people say this a lot, but I mean it with the most deepest reverence. Now I love grief because it makes me act in ways that are helping me go towards a truly fulfilling life, I guess, if I can say in a few minutes.
Yeah, grief completely changed my relation to others because I wanted the other to be real with me. At the time I meet them, I don't want to go to the bullshit time because we all gonna die, so let's do it now, let's meet now and let's love each other and share. And that time we were talking about is so important. And I'm thinking a lot about grieving in the community, the queer community. We lose so many people because, well, I'm 50, from AIDS or suicide. It's so much deep into the community. So we need to know how to deal with the grief and to accept that and to make it like a joyful moment, because it's so much... c'est tellement accolé à nous, à la façon dont on vit, que pour le moment, je ne suis plus capable d'avoir des relations avec des personnes qui ne veulent pas réfléchir à la mort tout de suite. You know, many people live in denial of death into our society of consommation. They don't want to talk about that, but we should and we have to, because death is love and we need to love each other a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. There's something, it's something that I've read again and again and again, right? That you don't grieve if you don't love, and that loss is the price of love somehow. And it's sad, but I definitely think that if something I can share about my grief is that I think it's the year that I learned to feel. And I've always presented myself as someone with a lot of feeling and who knows how to feel, but like, no way. Like it's a thing, it's a bit like Nessie was saying, it's a thing to notice you have uncomfortable sensations in your body, but it's something else to be able to sit with it because you have nothing else you can do than to feel the things. And for me, grief and learning to lean toward the grief because there's no other way has been... And it's still an opportunity for me to open the door to love, because I do believe now that you can't love if you can't grieve. Mm. and that if you're resisting or denying the fact that you lose people, that people die, that everything is going to end somehow. Well, yeah, I do believe that somehow we also close the door to loving because we're afraid that we're going to get hurt. But the fact is that sometimes life is also painful, and that embracing the whole array of the colors of the experience we're in this life is also the way to experience a fully erotic life in the way of feelings, feeling everything that this life is giving us.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So, if one of you have any last words.
Yeah, I want people to touch themselves. Hein? Touchez-vous. Si vous n'êtes pas capable de vous faire toucher par d'autres, touchez-vous, caressez-vous, faites-vous du bien, aimez-vous. Grieving with your body is so important.
I can say I've definitely become so good at rejection. Like, I'm so good at being rejected, so good at rejecting others in a kind of compassionate and dignified way. And like, I think it kind of comes back to Mathilde saying, is like, you know, life is short. You gotta go for the real authentic stuff right away. Like, there's no time to waste to be like, oh, I think this is kind of okay as a relationship. I think this connection is kind of working. Like, if it's not, it's not. It's like, rejection feels so good. Oh, thank God you rejected me. I did not enjoy those mixed signals, you know? Like, now I can move on to, like, try to fuck or, you know, flirt with somebody else.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for being there, for being so vulnerable. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Just being able, if you didn't change your radio, or if you're like, okay, I'm going to come back to it in a website, just being able to listen to people grieving or mourning, I think is a very intimate and brave thing to do. So you were listening to Audio Smut. This was the Grief and Intimacy show, listening CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 6:57, and I'm going to leave you on my favorite grief song, the one only song that has been cradling me this year, and it's called The West Coast of Clare by Planks T.
Spanish Point, I knew I'd find you there. I stood on the white strand.
Gwen and Doug are getting a much-needed break this week, and this is a rebroadcast from 2022, June 22nd, of a book launch that we co-sponsored with the Raja Press.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla, your one-hour African current affairs show here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. I am sitting here remotely with Doug Miller, and we have a really nice show lined up for you, Doug.
Oh, it's amazing, and I'm so proud to have been part of this book launch. The International Brigade Against Apartheid, Secrets of the People's War that Liberated South Africa, published here in Canada by De Raja Press, edited by Ronnie Casserles, a famous old militant ANC and MK leader, along with Muff Anderson and Oscar Marlene, also from the MK days, part of MK being the armed wing of the African National Congress of South Africa. And these are stories of compelling stories of people who gave up everything in their everyday world in Canada and other places, to go and join the underground in South Africa. Gwen, in fact, there's something special about those people.
Yes, well, they're all special, but when the book was brought to our attention, Doug and I very quickly realized that we knew two of the contributors to the book. Martha Gordon and I had been down in Southern Africa